Welcome to The Journey, a chronological study which goes through Scripture from Genesis to Revelation in chronological order.
Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. He says, "Do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." I think this is one of those verses we've heard so often that we forget to laugh. And I do want to stress that I really do think that Jesus is using big, extreme pictures here with the intention of softening not the point of the message, but the offense of the message by using humor. And if you actually try to visualize what he's talking about, you know, a big old log in one person's eye, you know, and that person is trying to help another guy get a little speck of dust out of his eye, you can see he's using imagery which is intended to produce, I think, a little chuckle. But we forget that about Jesus. We just, everything is scripture and you're not supposed to chuckle at scripture. And so I think I just want to start by reminding us that this is Jesus preaching a sermon. This is a point of humor here. And it has a really significant message, of course. But he knows also that it's hard, that this is hard for us, that he's about to launch into some real challenges for us. And one of them is the idea of not judging others and ignoring what we ourselves have to work on, that our tendency is a lot of this message has been for the self-righteous, right? A lot of this has been about not being self-righteous, about being poor in spirit, about not worrying about the appearance of righteousness and doing all your good works before men so that they'll think how great you are. So a lot of this has been exhortations against self-righteousness. And I think he's recognizing that this kind of hypocritical judgment where we ignore our own glaring issues and focus on other people's and are critical of them, it's really kind of the defense of the self-righteous. It's what we do when we're trying to preserve our own sense of, you know, superiority or righteousness based upon what we do. And so he's been really recognizing that all along. And so I think here, you know, where he was saying, don't just do what you do for the appearance, now he's saying, you know, be careful about judging other people for their appearance. Be careful about judging what other people do. And I think even when he says, you know, with the judgment you use, you will be judged, there's a lot of ways to read that. But I think as we keep going, I think you'll see that I think at least to some degree, Jesus's point is to take the golden rule and drive it into the heart. So in the same way that he talked about, you know, adultery and murder and vows and all these other things, and he said you've heard about these things on a physical, superficial level, now I want you to think about what it means in your heart, I think he's doing the same thing here with the golden rule. He's saying not only do you know that you should do what you want others to do to you, but now he's saying I want you to think about other people the way you want them to think about you. I want you to judge other people the way you would want to be judged, with mercy and grace and not a lot of, you know, diligent attention to the speck in your eye. You would want other people to recognize their own issues before they start really coming after yours. So there is a lot here that I think is important. And of course, all of it is. But I think it's easy to see how this comes on the heels of the really difficult challenges to pursue real righteousness, which the previous verses were all about. What do you focus on? What are you devoted to? Is it your appearance or is it actual righteousness? And I think part of the reason this comes on the heels of that is because as he's challenging people, I think most pastors have seen this, and I think probably most congregants have experienced this as well. I know I have as also a listener in the congregation. This idea where when a really challenging sermon is preached, I will oftentimes have someone come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I really wish my husband had been here, or I really wish my mom had been here, or I really wish my daughter had been here, not for the encouragement, but because they're doing it wrong and they really needed to hear this message. And I think Jesus is kind of saying to them, hold on, before you start hearing all the challenges I've said and pointing your fingers at the Pharisees or the zealots or the commoner or anybody, you know, think about yourself. So I think that's part of why it comes on the heels of that, because he knows that those challenges could lead to judging others. as a way of defending ourselves from responding to the challenges he's given. Like I said, I think it's kind of a mental golden rule, you know, and I think that's, if you would want to be given the benefit of the doubt, then you should be giving other people the benefit of the doubt. If you would want to be treated with mercy, you should be treating other people with mercy. If you want to be given some grace, you should be judging other people with grace as well. So it's not just do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but think about others as you want them to think about you. So once again, Jesus takes these standards and drives them even deeper. And I think that's, I think even thinking that way, recognizing even in your thoughts about other people, is this how I would want people to think about me if the situation were reversed? I think that's pretty significant, pretty important. It's interesting that the very next thing he says, he goes from don't judge people to a statement which requires some judgment of people. So the very next thing he says is, do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and turn and tear you to pieces. So he's just said, don't judge people. But then he gets to this point where you have to judge whether someone is a dog or a pig if you're going to be able to apply this verse. So before I tell you my thoughts, what do you guys think? How do you reconcile these ideas? Don't judge or you'll be judged. But then somehow you have to be able to recognize who's a dog and who's a pig so you don't do the wrong thing and end up torn apart by them. Why? How can these both be in the same sermon? Yeah, go.
Well, I can kind of see a connection where it's about, it's really not our job to control other people. So it's not our job to judge them if we are having issues of our own. And even if we're right about them, are we just throwing the pearls before the pigs? Like, is our judgment or our trying to help them, which is often, I think, actually control, going to be beneficial to them? So if not, what's the
I think that's really good. Yeah, I think that is one of the things that does flow, is that if you're thinking you want to help someone take the speck out, Jesus never said don't take specks out of people's eyes. He just said, first of all, it's kind of silly to do that if you've got a log in your own. So be aware of that first. But I do think you could, I think what you're saying is very plausible. You could see the next part of the flow is also be careful. If you're going to help somebody who themselves is sort of hypocritical and judgmental and not aware of the logs in their own eyes, you know, be aware, they may not receive it. You know, it may be a pearl, it may be a real gem of wisdom you're giving them, but if they're not in the right place, they may not receive it. And in fact, they may just tear you apart for it. So I think that's not a bad take, that when he talks about the pearls, he's actually talking about correction and help and things you might do to help someone else. And he's saying, number one, be careful that you're not being hypocritical about it. And number two, be careful if they even want it. So I think that's not bad. What else? Any other thoughts?
But I'm thinking that it said to examine yourself, know who and what you are first. It doesn't say don't judge other people, but it does tell you that you need to be aware of who and what you are and take that into the equation before you start judging anybody else.
Yeah, I think as far as like helping the speck, right? He doesn't say don't take the speck or don't help them with the speck. He just says, yeah, it's ridiculous to do it when you have a plank. He does start the whole thing by saying, do not judge. So there is something he means by judge that he doesn't want us to do in general, or at least to recognize that if we do it, we should expect again that we'll be judged in a similar manner. So I think that golden rule, that mental golden rule, comes in. I think there is another aspect.
I think that piece is for the person who gossips so much they don't even know they're doing it.
Yeah, that's certainly part of it.
We've all met those people and they're just shocked when you say something about it. So don't judge or you too will be judged, or for those people who are the hypocrites who go around and don't even know how bad they are because they've done it so much.
Sure. I think another difference between the beginning of this and the don't give dogs what is sacred part that goes a little bit back to a different piece of what Lorraine had said is the control issue, that it could be the beginning is, you know, don't be judging people in a condescending way, as Lorraine said, to control them, to ostensibly help them. But on the other hand, we are encouraged to have discernment about what will hurt us. Because notice in that second part, it isn't just about identifying what's wrong with them. It's one thing to go around just saying, well, this is wrong with you, and this is wrong with you, and this is wrong with you, even in our heads. It's another thing to say, this person is not safe for me. And if I say this to them, it will come back on me. So I do think there's wisdom in recognizing that we can discern that. There's wisdom in discerning whether someone is really legitimately not out for your good, and then avoiding being in that position. But that's different from simply walking around, you know, kind of identifying people who are wrong, or what they're doing wrong, or what their specs are. So I think that's another possible way to look at it. I kind of lean towards the first thing we said, that by pearls, he's really talking about helping people, and that all flows that way, but you could go either way with it. So Luke 6, verse 37 is the same basic message. He says, do not judge and you will not be judged. Do not condemn and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. And what's interesting is I don't expect you to remember this, but if you're looking at it, you'll see that for Luke, this does come on the heels of the golden rule. That in Luke, this comes after Jesus has talked about the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. So I think the connection here is even more clear, that these ideas, don't judge, you know, judge people the way you want to be judged. Don't condemn people because you don't want to be condemned, and forgive people because you want to be forgiven. You know, there is this idea mentally, how would you want to other people to think of you, to treat you, even in their own minds? And so I think the connection is a little clearer even in Luke, because we already read those passages, but it does come from those before. But Luke also goes on to expand this in a more positive way. He says, give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Now, this is often used by preachers when they want you to tithe, because they will often say, if you tithe, you'll get a lot more money from God. And while I think, I don't want to eliminate the principle that I think at times God does, you know, God can choose to do that, and sometimes he does reward actual generosity. There's some people in my life who've been generous to me, who I am delighted when I see that they are prospering. I just think, I love it when generous people prosper, and there is a verse which actually says that. So there is maybe some sort of principle there, as long as you don't make it a promise and turn it into prosperity gospel. But I would say, more to the point, I don't think he's just talking or even primarily talking about material things here. I think this is coming on the heels of how we mentally treat people. So I think he's talking about being generous in your view of other people. Again, believing the best, giving them the benefit of the doubt, you know, choosing to forgive instead of condemn, choosing to give mercy instead of judgment. And if you're generous in that way with others, you will also get that generosity back. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And that lines up with what he says, according to Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, in the same way you judge, the measure you use, it will be measured to you. So I think Luke is talking primarily about a generous spirit. Now, that can certainly be applied to material things as well, and I think it often is, so I'm not denying that. But I think that the real principle here, which I don't want us to get bogged down in the material aspect, I think the principle here is the exhortation to be generous of spirit, and to understand that God will always be more generous of spirit than you are. So you can never be so generous of spirit that you will end up impoverished spiritually, at least. Again, I will never make the promise that you can't give away all your money. Maybe you can. But I do think that in terms of your generosity of spirit, we can never be more generous than God. And as generous as he's been to us with his grace, you know, he's encouraging us to be that way with other people. Don't judge, don't condemn, forgive, show mercy. You know, really treat people in that way. And I think that's a really positive thing. Anybody have any thoughts on that?
I think it's interesting, because I think there's something about this that just makes sense logically in general too, right? I mean, I think that's kind of where the idea of karma comes from. People who aren't willing to believe that there's an actual, like, God, a higher power, still have this feeling that, like, to some extent, there's something about the way you behave affects the way people behave towards you, right? There's a logic to it.
Right. Yeah. And even in the secular world, they can acknowledge that psychologically, right? That's often going to happen.
Yeah.
Your relationships with other people. I think it's interesting, just maybe the balance is to connect this to what was in Matthew, where Matthew says, don't give your pearls before swine, which means you can't, there are some people that you may be generous of spirit and they will still trample you under their feet. So you can't always insist that people follow this principle. Sometimes they won't. But I think you're to recognize that those people are, in a sense, please don't, if you go around judging them and calling them this, you're probably missing the whole point of this passage. But they are, in a sense, swines and dogs, and they're not going to respond rationally. And for people who generally are so wounded that when you are generous of spirit, they can't be generous back, that's okay. The promise is that God, I think, will continue to be more generous. And yes, other people often will. There's a principle there. But I think the balance and the recognition is that some people, even when you give them pearls, are just going to trample you under their feet. And that's important. Well,
and it's interesting too, because just a little while ago in Matthew, Jesus talked about if someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn and give him the left. If he asks for your cloak, give it. So that he is already setting that expectation as well. Like, you do these things, sure, not because it will be given to you in the same measure, but because this is what I'm asking, this is what I'm calling you to do.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And I just like even the connection of all these things to the fact that he's been giving all these challenges, so that the crowd is being encouraged not to walk away and say, well, you know, John, you know, gets slapped on the cheek and just slaps back. And Bill, you know, he's forced to walk 1 mile. He grumbles the whole time. You know, Jesus is like, that's not what you should be doing with this message. You should be looking at the plank in your own eye, and then you should continue to be generous of spirit and stop judging whether other people are being as generous of spirit as you are. And I think that's a hard thing for us. We always want to, you know, this is why, again, in the McGill family, we try, because, and it's a motto because it's so hard to do, be nicer to people than they are to you. I think that's just a hard standard. And it's one that we could often justify not following, right? And we see it all the time, the whataboutism, right? Well, I should be nice, but what about them? They're not. And I think Jesus is saying, be nice, be nicer, be more generous of spirit. Yes, Meredith.
What also kind of reminded me too, like when we were going through the Sermon on the Mount and stuff, and how we kind of talked how it would probably be kind of encouraging maybe to like some of the people who like thought they should like be like the Pharisees and like follow the Pharisees, and Chuck kind of making that like contrast too about like what the kingdom of heaven is actually like. And like, I mean, obviously he's talking to everyone, not just the Pharisees, but it would kind of be like kind of an encouragement and like a more like doable thing, and kind of like, yeah, what you do matters, and it's like seen and it's like important.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And I like the idea that as much as he's been challenging the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this still applies to the common fishermen out there who can't say, well, now I get to judge the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, because if they do, now they're missing this part of the message too. So I think that's really good. Yeah, I like that. He goes on in Luke 6. He says, he also told them this parable. Can the blind lead the blind? Will they not both fall into a pit? The student is not above the teacher, but everyone who is fully trained will be like their teacher. Now, as we've talked about, not everything necessarily has to flow. I mean, Jesus could move to a new topic, or it could be that Luke is piecing some things together. So I don't know that this flows necessarily from the previous passage, although I'm interested if any of you have some ideas in your head of how it does. One way it might is... actually, no, I was going to say one way it might is the whole pearls and swine thing, but that's in Matthew, so that wouldn't flow here in Luke. But it does remind me of that, in that I think part of what Jesus is doing here is encouraging people, again, while you're not judging people, there's still room for discernment of whether someone is going to lead you into a pit. So maybe it's similar to the pearls and swine statement, but it's a different parable saying the same thing. You should have discernment of whether your teacher, your leader, is in fact blind. Because if he is, and you just follow him anyway, you're going to end up in a pit. And not only that, but you're going to become like him. No student is going to be, you know, you can't simply say, well, I like this guy, and even though he's saying a bunch of wrong stuff, I'm still going to follow him, but I'm going to be better than him, and I won't end up where he is. I think his point is, No, you're going to tend to be like the teacher that you follow. So have some discernment about who you're following. So I think this could be dual-edged. It could be to the teachers that they have some accountability to not be blind and to recognize that the people that they're discipling will be like them. And so to ask themselves, am I being the person I want them to be? But I think more so even for the followers to say, is that the guy I want to follow? Is that the guy I want to be with? And in that sense, it could be that balance that Matthew has Jesus give with the swine, that yes, don't judge people. Don't be condemning them. Believe the best. Give them the benefit of the doubt. Be generous of spirit. But when it comes to you and how it impacts you and whether you're following them as leaders, well, then you have to make some judgments. You have to make some discernment and say, nope, this guy is going to lead me into a pit and I don't want to go there with him. So I think that might be some of the balance there. Let me just go on. And then if you guys have comments, we'll come back. But I want to go on because he does connect it here to the other part in Matthew. He goes on to the story that Matthew gave. He says, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? Which is interesting coming off of the blindness, right? Because what might be making your teacher blind is that plank. You know, his own blind spot might be his own sin, his own struggle. So it's as a leader, be aware of it. As a follower, it's also okay to be aware of it. You can still love him, still be generous of spirit, but you don't have to follow him if that blind spot is leading him into a pit. So why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How could you say to your brother, brother, let me take the speck out of your eye when you fail yourself to see the plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your eye, and then you can clearly see to remove the speck from your brother's eye. So any comments on all of the blind parable here?
There we go. Well, I was just thinking that this whole like section just also like just has the like kind of the air of like humility, and even just thinking like the teacher like and the student, you know, and stuff, and how kind of they're like on the same playing ground with God. And I know the other one was with like Matthew and stuff, but some of it was like similar and stuff. And when I talked about it like with Matthew, and then it was just kind of right before that too, was kind of talking about like how God provides and like he's in control, you know, like everything, and everything comes back to like depending on him, basically going like his way.
I think that's good. And I think, in fact, as we go on in Matthew, we'll see some of that. I think the next verses make sense from that perspective, Meredith, of a dependence on God. So we'll get there in a second. Anybody else have any thoughts before we do move on in Matthew? All right, so let's do that then. Matthew 7, verses 7 through 20. This is interesting because the next verses, again, don't necessarily feel like they flow. They could just be another topic. They could be about prayer. They appear to be. We know he talked about prayer earlier with the Lord's Prayer, so maybe he's just coming back to that. He might just keep circling back. But I actually wonder if it's what Meredith was saying, that these next verses actually have to do with what you're supposed to do when you have a plank in your eye and you're not sure what to do about it, right? If I have a blind spot, how am I supposed to even get rid of it? How am I supposed to know what it looks like? How am I supposed to get around it? If I'm blind and I'm leading people, how do I not lead them into a pit? You know, once you recognize you're poor in spirit, what are you supposed to do about that? So I think that might be what these next verses are about, but let's read them. They're familiar to you. But in that context, think about how they might flow just a little bit different. He says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, the one who seeks finds, and to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. Certainly, you can apply this to the gospel. It is true. We know these things are true about the gospel as well. If you seek God, you'll find him. If you ask for salvation, you'll receive it. That's all true. But I wonder if in the context here, if it really isn't about I need help, right? Okay, so I'm not supposed to judge other people, and I'm supposed to remove the plank from my own eye. I'm supposed to make sure I'm not blind, but I don't know how to remove that plank. It may come back to you. So guess what? God is here. He's ready to help. And that might be what Jesus is saying. You need help? Ask and you'll receive, right? Knock and the door will be opened. If there's something you need, Jesus is ready to let you in. You know, if you're seeking help, you will find it, you know? So it could be that. It could be that this is sort of the linchpin in our generosity of spirit to being able to change ourselves, is to seek God in that and to trust that he will be there to help us. And it does fit also for Matthew, one of the points we've seen over and over, and which is important to Matthew as a gospel writer, it does fit that whole picture that he is trying to paint of God being there to give equal access to everybody, that he does not keep the door closed from anybody. You don't have to be rich. You don't have to be powerful. In fact, if you recognize you're poor in spirit, your access is easier to see, you know, and in light of that, it makes sense that Matthew would then point out that Jesus said, just ask, I'm here. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to earn anything. You don't have to work harder. You don't have to pay. Just knock on the door. You need help, just ask, and I'll give it to you. So it kind of fits the flow to me in that sense. I want to read a little bit more because it goes on to talk about asking and how God gives that access to everybody. And then for sure, I want to hear you guys' comments. He goes on, he says, which of you, if your son asks for bread, will give him a stone? Which definitely seems to flow right from the previous comment. Look, you ask, God will give, God will help. He's ready to help because he's like a good father. If your son asked you for bread, would you give him a stone? That would be super cruel and disappointing. It says, which of you, if your son asked for bread, will give him a stone? If he asked for a fish, will give him a snake? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? He says, look, you know that you're not very good. He actually says evil. I'm being more generous. He says, you know, you're not very good as fathers. And yet even you understand that you want to give good things to your children. Imagine how the perfect God of grace and mercy and love, imagine how much more eager he is to give to you help, what you want, what you need. Just ask, because he is poised. You don't have to persuade him. You don't have to coerce him. You don't have to convince him. You don't have to prove how worthy you are of what you're asking for. He's a good father who wants to give you those good gifts. So just ask. So of course it's related to prayer, but it also seems to connect to everything he's been saying about recognizing your poor in spirit, which will lead you to ask for help. So rather than being defensive about your poverty in spirit, rather than being self-righteous and pretending to be better than you are, rather than turning your self-righteousness into judgment against others and putting them down so you feel better, rather than doing all those things, just acknowledge, I'm a mess just like everybody else. I have a plank in my eye. Maybe in some ways I'm a worse mess, who knows? But the point is, I can just ask God for help. I don't have to keep pushing away. I don't have to keep persuading God that I'm better than I am. He knows. And I don't have to worry about what other people think. I just need to be asking God for that help. And that seems to be a nice sort of point to reach in this sermon after all these challenges that are very hard. So any thoughts, any comments that you guys have on any of that?
I like that, because especially to like, kind of like my literal mind goes to like, oh, I need to be better. I need to not do these things. I need to be like, you know, like, am I judging someone? Which are challenges and they're good to look at, but like the idea is more like about being poor in spirit and seeking God and like having him, like, you know, like, I guess, change you, although it doesn't exactly say that here, but it's more kind of like that. And he acknowledges that, you know, we are evil and like, well, I mean, we're not anymore with the new heart and stuff, but that like we are evil and we are like way messed up. So it's like, okay, so God knows like that is like too much for that. And we're not going to be able to do that on our own. It's kind of a pointing to like, yeah, how you need to be born in spirit type thing. So I find that like really encouraging.
It's good. Yeah, me too. So Matthew then gives us a summary in this way. He says, so in everything, in your behavior, in your speech, and even in your thoughts towards others, in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets. Pretty impressive. I mean, in other places, Jesus and Paul say the law and prophets are summed up in the gospel. I think both can be true. And in this case, he's talking about kind of how we should live as people of the gospel. And the point is, well, everything, all of the law and all of the things that the prophets exhorted us to be and to do, all of those exhortations, all of those rebukes, all of those reproofs, all of those encouragements can all be summed up in this golden rule. Do to others what you would have them do to you. But Jesus has already reminded him, it goes beyond just mere appearance. It's even in your heart. It's even in your thoughts. It's even in the way you think of others. It's the way you treat others. And he puts it as his summary. It's kind of interesting. Luke kind of puts it as the thesis and then goes from it. Matthew kind of leads up to it and puts it as a summary. Again, entirely plausible to me that Jesus preached this sermon both ways. And like a lot of good preachers, maybe he did both. He told them at the beginning what he was going to say, then he said it, and then he said it again at the end. But either way, I think the point that Matthew and Luke both would want to say is this was a linchpin of Jesus's approach to how we ought to live with each other. Think about how you would want to be treated in everything and treat others that way. And I think it's one of those things that's kind of easy to, you know, agree with. But it's another thing to actually practically apply that as you go through your day, because the reality is it's so easy for us to not give a second thought to how we treat someone else, but give a lot of thought throughout our day to how we want to be treated. And to turn that over, to use that instinctive sense of how we want to be treated to actually help us treat other people better, it's kind of brilliant. And it helps us to not have to sort of be super introspective and try to guess what people want. A lot of times you can get there through, well, what would I want? How would I want to be treated? It's not a 100% formula. Sometimes people are so different from you, they don't want what you want, but it's okay. Still gives you that idea of how you should be approaching life with other people. There is an interesting thing. I was reading that this idea, the golden rule, was in concept not new. There's a rabbi named Hillel, who's the grandfather of Gamaliel. We'll get to Gamaliel later because he's actually the teacher. He's the mentor of Paul when Paul is Saul. We'll get to all that later, but just kind of known throughout history as kind of a brilliant rabbi to the extent that rabbis existed at that time. But Hillel is kind of his grandfather, also known as Hillel the Elder, known as a very smart teacher of the law. And he had said, he had sort of a golden rule, which he had popularized, which was kind of famous even at the time Jesus was around, because Hillel predates Jesus by a little bit. I mean, he may have been contemporaries, but he's older. So Hillel said, don't do to other people what you wouldn't want them to do to you. So he put it in sort of a negative form to keep you from being mean to people, right? If you don't want people to treat you this way, don't treat them that way. What one of the commentaries pointed out, which I think is really interesting, is that even in that, Jesus pushes further. He takes something they're familiar with and he says, it's not enough to simply say, don't be mean. He turns it around and says, actually be aggressively kind. Don't just stop doing what you don't want others to do to you. But on the other hand, actually do for them what you wish they would do for you. And it is very like Jesus to take a law or a principle they're familiar with and sort of push it even further in and say, yeah, you can be passive and not be mean, or you can actually go further and be kind and be aggressively kind. And I think that's kind of where he's going. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Any other thoughts on the golden rule before we press on? Because even though he summed it up, he's not done talking. Very like a preacher. All right. Well, now he says this, which again, another verse you've heard out of context a lot. And again, its application to the gospel is extremely acceptable and plausible and might be what Jesus meant. Because I think everything can be applied to the gospel in one sense or another, because that's what Jesus is all about. So I'm not disputing that, but I do want us to take this in the context of the whole sermon and see there might be something else going on here, which might even make a little more sense. But this is what he says. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. So I think it is true that this can be an application of the gospel, like I said, that in the scheme of all of history, you could argue that the people who come to the gospel are sort of few. However, that isn't true at every point in history. There are still millions and millions and millions and billions of people that have become Christians. And for all we know, there will be billions and trillions more. We don't know how long it's going to go. So it seems a little bit weird and has sometimes led, again, to this idea of Christianity being hard to get into and only available to certain people because it's this really narrow gate. I think in one sense, remember that Jesus is a gate who is wide enough for everybody to come through. He is the only gate, but he himself does not restrict access to himself. He gives it to everybody. So I think we have to be careful that our message, if we think this is about the gospel, that it doesn't become a way of saying that, you know, kind of throwing up our hands and saying, well, most people aren't going to accept the gospel anyway. I don't know that that's what it's saying. But if you put it in the context of the sermon, it seems a little different anyway. It seems like what Jesus is saying is, hey, I know that all these things I've just told you, they're countercultural. They're not what people do, right? I'm telling you, turn the other cheek. I'm telling you, treat people the way you want to be treated. I'm telling you, don't judge people. I'm telling you, ask me for help and don't pretend to be righteous. I'm telling you all those things that everybody looks at and applauds you for, stop doing it for their applause. I think in a sense, he's saying, look, I know you're right. As you think about everything I've asked you to do, you're like, good grief, Jesus, nobody does this. This is not realistic. This is not the way the world works. And I think he's saying, you're right. You're right. Because the gate, the way that I'm asking you to live your life, and you could, if you wanted, see him sort of mirroring Proverbs. If you remember when, and of course, everybody, Jesus and all the Jews there would be very familiar with Proverbs. You remember that in Proverbs, we talked about how the whole book of Proverbs is this picture of the road that leads to life and the road that leads to destruction. And Solomon says that very few, too few people take the road to life. The road to destruction is broad and really pleasing to people. And I think that might be what Jesus is echoing here, that he's saying, yeah, I know everything I'm saying to you is not popular. It's not sort of the way that people tend to go. I understand that. But guess what? The way people tend to go leads to destruction. The really broad and wide road that seems comfortable, where you don't turn the other cheek and you don't think about other people and you do things for applause, that may feel good, but that leads to destruction. And I think he might just be acknowledging that. Yeah, you're right. I'm asking you to do something a lot of people won't do. It's a small gate. It's a narrow road. And only a few people are going to find it. Only a few people are going to be willing to live their lives this way. Now, you could still receive the gospel, but again, Jesus hasn't gotten to talking about what the gospel is yet in terms that we understand them, because he just hasn't. He hasn't even died yet, so I don't think he could begin to explain that to them. So you could receive the gospel and not live your life this way, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of Christians do, right? They receive the gospel, and they're growing, but part of growing is learning how to live in this countercultural way, in this narrow way that the rest of the world doesn't do. And I think ultimately God pushes us all that way. I'm not saying it's a lost cause, but I think it's good for us to recognize if we read the Sermon on the Mount and it looks to us like the way that everybody lives anyway, I think we're not reading it right. I think it should be challenging. It should feel countercultural. And Christianity is always countercultural, not just for the sake of being different, but because really loving people is not something that humans do really well. Maybe at brief moments, at brief times, but for the most part throughout history, we don't do that well in the long haul. And so I think that's what he's really encouraging, is that golden rule. It seems so simple. Why is it not that the whole world lives by the golden rule? It's such a simple principle. Well, because it's kind of narrow and it's not as broad and it doesn't feel as good sometimes. So I think that's really what he's emphasizing here is, hey, I am calling you to something that is going to be not popular. You thought I was this populist messenger at the beginning because I said some things you really liked. But yeah, what I'm calling you to is kind of narrow. And he's challenging them. Do you want to live that narrow way? Do you want to follow this path? By all means, do, because I've shown you through this sermon, or at least I've expressed through this sermon, all the rewards that you'll get, the generosity with which you'll be treated, the mercy with which you will understand God's grace, all of that. You know, I've told you you'll be blessed if you take this route. But a lot of people won't anyway. So consider it. Consider that and understand it will be not where all your friends are going all the time. It will not be where the whole rest of the world goes all the time. It might be a really different direction. So I think that's kind of where he's going with that. And now he goes back to, I think, what has been part of the message with the swine. If it's not, that's okay. He's making it really clear now. But it might have been part of the message before was that, you know, who are those swines? And in Luke, the idea of the blind leading the blind. I think throughout this, he is giving them exhortation also to be careful about who they follow. That Jesus is giving them some strange advice, and they have to make a decision. Am I going to follow Jesus's strange advice, or am I going to follow the advice of these teachers that I've had all along, who are going to tell me Jesus is wrong, who are going to tell me that I should pray loudly and publicly, who are going to tell me that I need to look out for myself first? I think he's saying to them, now you have a choice to make. And that's when he says this: watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. So this is a message, again, we've heard so often, we sort of pass over. But again, think of the imagery, think of the care with which Jesus is speaking. This is intended to be a little bit alarming. He's saying false prophets are not just people who are well-intentioned. False prophets are not, there may be well-intentioned people who are just blind, but he's saying that's not even what I'm talking about right now. False prophets are not just people who are well-intentioned. He's saying, believe it or not, there are people out there who want to teach you things that are wrong because they want to destroy you, because they're more interested in their own hunger than they are in really leading you to safety. Watch out for those people. They're not only blind, they may also be blind. In fact, I would assume they are. They may have a plank in their eye. They probably do. But they also are more interested in feeding their own hunger than they are in helping you. But they will act like they're on your side. They will act like they're helping you. They will act like they are out for the little guy, but that's not what they're doing. They're actually leading you to destruction, and they're not even well-intentioned about it. I don't know that they have a desire to destroy you particularly, but their desire for power, their desire for prestige, their desire for money, their desire, their hungers are so much bigger that they don't care if they destroy you in the process. And I think throughout history, from the Old Testament up to the present day, you can find prophets and teachers who fit this category. And Jesus is saying, it's okay to judge them. It's okay to discern those people and stay away, because they are here to hurt you. They will trample you under their feet. And he goes on to tell you, how do you do it? Do you just look at someone and say, I got a sense? No, he says, here's how you do it. He says, by their fruit, you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? He says, you guys are smart farmers. You know that if you go to a thorn bush or a thistle, you're not going to find figs no matter how much you look. Quit looking in those places where the fruit isn't and saying, well, maybe it's just, I think this wants to be a fig tree. No, quit it. There are no figs there. Quit going there. He says, you don't waste your time with that. You go where the figs are, and you go where the grapes are. He says, likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. Again, I think he's just making a principle. Now, I think with everything he said before, it's really important we understand this is not used for us to be scornful, dismissive, and mean to the people around us. We don't get to just look at people and say, I don't like their fruit. They're bad people. I'm going to judge them. This is specifically for who we're going to follow, for who's going to teach us. I think there's room and even exhortation for compassion and mercy and grace with people around us, because we all at times are thistles. But I think that he's also saying, as far as who you follow, you're going to become like them, and you're going to be destroyed, and you're going to fall in a pit, and you're going to be trampled. You're going to be eaten like a sheep. Whatever the analogy you want is, he's trying to protect people by saying, you are allowed, you are encouraged to judge the fruit of those people who want to lead you, who are claiming to be your teachers, who say they're out for your benefit. They may speak persuasively, but what is their fruit? What are they producing? Are they producing healthy, whole people? Are there other disciples doing well? Or are they producing controlled, abused people? Are they themselves loving people as Jesus talked about? Or do you not see love as one of their fruits? John, in 1 John, is going to go into much more detail about this. John actually has a whole sort of system of how you can discern false teachers from true ones, and he's going to show the kind of fruit you can look for. We'll save that till we get to 1 John. But in the overview, that's what Jesus is saying here. So he goes on, a good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Again, we have to be careful. Keep this in the context. Can people fool other people for a long time? They can. But in reality, a bad tree cannot bear good fruit, and a good tree cannot bear bad fruit. So he's just trying to get people out of this habit, or even this temptation of saying, that guy is persuasive, he's charming, I really want to follow him, other people follow him, so I'm going to overlook the bad fruit. I'm just going to ignore it. I'm just going to say, he's in my camp, he's in my tribe, he shares my worldview, so I'm going to overlook the bad fruit. And Jesus is saying, you can't do that. If the fruit is there, the rest of that doesn't matter. He may tell you you're brilliant. He may agree with you on all the things you think are important. He may have a worldview that's comfortable to you. Whatever it is, you cannot overlook the fruit. So he says, every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. How do you know the teachers? How do you know the prophets you should follow? By their fruit. Look for the fruit. And whatever it is, you have an obligation there to be discerning, to make a judgment. Say, I'm going to follow that person. I'm not going to follow that person. Again, do not extend this to how you treat your neighbor, whether you love your neighbor or not. Again, you can love your neighbor. You can be gracious. You can be compassionate. You can even be generous of spirit. But that doesn't mean you have to follow them where they're going. And so that's the distinction here. And I think it's really important. I've spent some time on that because I think it's a really important message. I'm not going to go into details because I don't think I need to, because I think that the judging fruit is enough. But I think we live in a day and age where we're not as good at discerning that in the church. And there are people in the church, I'm not judging their salvation, but we can judge their fruit and say, I'm not going to follow that person. I'm not going to go where that person goes. And I think that's fair. I think that's fair to do. I think it's important to do. I think we have to do it. So I think it's relevant. I think it's always relevant. False prophets, if you think about it, false prophets have been a problem and an exhortation to be aware of from at least Deuteronomy through now Matthew. So that's a lot of the Bible where that's an important thing. Okay, so I'll take a pause there. Anybody else have anything on that? Yes, go ahead.
Well, I think that's really good. And I think it is like obviously the order of this message is important too, because some of the stuff Jesus did at the beginning where he really turns the idea of power and success on its head. He's also in some ways, not completely, but redefining what good fruit looks like. It doesn't just look like numbers or what one person might see as being like, quote, effective. It's this poor in spirit, this love for other people, this dependence on God. And so even, you know, and I think today that still can be so difficult because that doesn't always feel, pulling back to the narrow versus the broad gate, it doesn't always feel like life, some of those things that Jesus says are good fruit.
I think that's a really good point. Yeah, I like that. He's helped us know what good fruit should look like before he says, judge them by their fruit. That's good. That's really good. Any other thoughts?
Well, I was also thinking like, well, it kind of goes like, I guess it kind of goes with that. But yeah, no, I like that. And I like what you said too. And he's really bringing in just like another level of like accountability, you know, with himself coming, like for everybody. Because I was just thinking like even like with the Pharisees, I mean, then that's a huge level of accountability. And then that, you know, goes to the people that are like looking at it and stuff like that. But
yeah, that's really good. And when you talk about accountability, it's fascinating. He's not exempting himself from this, right? He's like, judge me by my fruit. Go for it. You know, and of course, there's a lot of fruit from him to judge, whether it's miracles or the way he loves people or the compassion he has. But I think it is interesting that this is not something that only applies to other people. This also, I think he would be delighted if people applied it to him. If they were like, oh, well, how does Jesus hold up under this scrutiny? Well, obviously really well. So I think that's cool. Yeah, I think that works well.
Well, that kind of also like goes with what we were talking about, like with him kind of learning how to be like a human and like his humanity too. And also just like being like under God, like taking the role of, you know, like following God and doing whatever, like, he says.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. His submission to the Father, even. Yeah, absolutely.
That's yeah, submission, I guess, would be good.
He is not, again, if anybody could be above sort of the law and the example, he could be. But that's one thing we've seen, even going back to his baptism, that he has been very careful to be a really good example, even of submission to the law, which, again, if anybody doesn't need to do that, it's God. but he's doing that, again, for our sake. Yeah, I think that's a good point, Meredith. I think that's really excellent. Yeah, for sure. Luke goes on, says similar passage in verse 43 through 45. He says, no good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. This is interesting. And here, Jesus actually begins to get into one of the details that John actually mentions in 1 John, which is that what people say matters. It's not everything, but it matters. And it does often come from the heart. Out of the heart, the mouth speaks is actually a proverb. This is just a repeat of that proverb. And I think that, again, can sometimes people say things that doesn't define who they are? Absolutely. Absolutely. But in general, you watch people talk and the way they talk and how what they say over and over and what their priorities are. You guys have been listening to me for years. You know a lot of things about me from the things I keep repeating. And you might not like some of those things, and you might like some of those things, and they might reveal some bad things in me, and they might reveal some good things. But the fact is, that's at least the danger of being a public speaker, is that people get to know you, even if you don't try to be known, because out of the heart, the mouth speaks, and what is your priority comes out. And I think so he's even saying here, part of the fruit you can look at, again, it's not everything, but part of the fruit you can look at is what they say. And again, I think what they consistently say in some ways, because that comes out of who they are. So you can't say, well, you know, just dismiss it and say, well, he didn't mean it. Well, maybe he didn't mean it once, maybe he didn't mean it twice, but is that the consistent fruit of the way he speaks or she speaks? Well, maybe they meant that. And so I think that even goes into that as well. Then we come to Matthew 7, 21 through 29, another verse that I've heard a lot pulled out and a lot of things made of it. And I'm not sure the wrong things made of it in this case, but let's, again, try to remember the context as we continue. So he's been talking about the narrow gate, the teachings, and how they're countercultural and they're different, and a lot of people won't necessarily follow these. He's been talking about beware of false prophets and watch for their fruit and know who they are by the fruit that they show. And as Lorian said, he's been talking about what fruit really looks like. And I think this next passage goes to that, where he wants to say, be careful what you think defines somebody who's truly following me and that narrow gate that you want to follow and not follow down the road of destruction. And he says this, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? And I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. What's fascinating to me about this is that he starts it by saying, I people who just call out my name, that's one thing, but people who are going to enter the kingdom of heaven are going to do the will of my Father. And then the question becomes, what does that look like? And so it's easy to start thinking, what are the works I have to do to get to heaven? What's fascinating is he picks the works here that they would be likely to associate with very spiritual people and says, I don't even know those people. So he's undermining, if his message is just about do the right things, if that's his message, number one, it undermines everything he's set up till now. But number two, he undermines that by then going on to say, guess what? These aren't the right things. So people who, and he doesn't even deny they're doing it, by the way. He doesn't say, no, you never prophesied. You never drove out demons. You never performed miracles. Maybe they did or didn't. He doesn't comment on that. He simply says, yeah, but I don't know you. You may have done those things in my name even. You may have claimed my authority in it, but I don't know you. I don't know who you are. And they're big, again, for us, they might sound a little weird, but I think you could fill in these blanks, these things that he says, pick whatever are sort of the hallmarks of spirituality for us today. What are the things that people would say, oh, that's a spiritual person in appearance? And that's what Jesus would put in these blanks, because that's what he does. People who are prophesying, people who are driving out demons, people who are performing miracles. He says, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about, doing the will of my Father in heaven. I think there's two things that are both true. One is the rest of the New Testament becomes very clear that the will of God is that we will submit to him in the gospel. The will of God is that we will say yes to the promise that he makes us, to the gift that he brings us. I do think it's not a stretch to say this is connected very strongly to the gospel, and that is the will of God. When you get to the bottom line, Hebrews tells us that, John tells us that, Jesus tells us that, Paul tells us that. It all comes down to what really is the will of God. It's to believe God. It's to trust him. It's to say yes to the gift he gives us. Having said that, I think you can also apply in another way this to the whole teaching he's just given and say that what he's saying is, again, I'm saying watch for the fruit. And I'm telling you, some of those people that you think are really fruitful, that you think you should be following because they're doing miracles and they're casting out demons and they're prophesying, you know what? I don't even know some of those guys. They don't know me. They say they're leading you to me. They say they're doing it in my name. They don't have the authority, because what they're not doing is everything I just talked about here. They're not poor in spirit. They're not righteous on the inside instead of just self-righteous. They're not avoiding hypocrisy. They are judgmental. Their fruit is bad. I think that's where this connects with the rest of that, is that he's not using this, I think, as an exhortation against the people he's speaking to specifically. I don't think he wants the fishermen listening to go, oh my gosh, I certainly haven't prophesied, driven out demons, or done miracles. I don't have a chance when I get to heaven. I think it's the other way around. I think he wants to say to them, you're thinking those guys are more on the right track. But if you're doing the things I said, if you're just following the golden rule, even and asking for help, if you're surrendering to God and submitting and saying, I'm poor in spirit, I need your help, that's the will of my Father. That's the people that know me. So you have equal access. You don't have to worry about what those teachers and prophets and demon exorcists seem to be doing. You don't have to do those things. That's not what I'm saying. And those guys who do those things, I may or may not know them. So I think that's kind of the thrust is an encouragement of what is fruit. When you're looking for the good fruit, the prophets you should follow, what does that look like? And I think he's saying it looks more like these things that anyone can do in one sense, because it's just about being poor in spirit and crying out to me and being merciful. And it doesn't look like these big sort of spiritual landmarks that you saw. So I kind of think that's the flow here. But again, I also think it is directly connected to the gospel, because the bottom line, that submission to God, comes down to submitting to saying yes to the gift he's given us. Nothing else matters if we don't do that. All right. Yes. Thoughts. I see Meredith.
Well, what you say makes a lot of sense. I mean, do you think these are actually things that they're just like lying about doing? Because it would seem like you would need to know God to prophesy in his name and drive out demons and perform miracles.
I don't know. I think it's interesting that he doesn't tell us that. He doesn't say they weren't doing those things. Certainly, I mean, so I don't know the answer to that, Meredith. Could they just be lying? Of course they could be. Right. Yeah. But you can claim to be prophesying in his name and not be prophesying in his name, just making stuff up. You can be claimed to be doing miracles and be a charlatan. So they could just be lying. But even Revelation talks about that in the end times, there will be people doing miracles who will not be of God. And that's why the elite need to be trusting God, because people will do things that look like God. And you think back to Moses, right? Moses, for a while, every miracle he did, the people of Egypt did, right? He turned his staff into a snake and they turned their staff into a snake. So it's kind of like, the scripture doesn't explain how that happened. Was it a trick? Was it chicanery? Was it demonic? We don't know. So I think
not only
here, then in this passage, he doesn't tell us whether they were doing it or not. I think you can argue they clearly weren't doing it by his authority in his name. That part is at least a lie. Yes, Lorian.
I was just going to say, we do see a couple instances of that in the Old Testament, the one you mentioned, and then also when Saul goes to the medium and she seems to summon the ghost of Samuel. And that's very weird. And the Bible doesn't explain why or how that appears to be working. So, I mean, we do see some of those odd examples that aren't fully explained, I think.
Actually, you also see that.
Although it seems let's say, yeah, we do have those, but then also like in the New Testament, like some of those things, well, I guess we do see that, and it just, yeah, like happens, although it goes badly for those people, but they still, yeah, that does happen.
In the book of Acts, there's Simon Bar, no, not Simon Bar-Jonah, that's Peter. There's
Simon Bar-Jesus. Name,
but there's a guy who is clearly not a believer, but it says he's really attracted to the power of the apostles. They keep going around and doing exorcisms and miracles, and it describes him as a miracle worker. It doesn't describe him as just a charlatan. It says he also was a miracle worker. Now he gets in trouble because he tries to cast out a demon, and the demon is like, I don't know you. I know Jesus and I know Paul, but I don't know who you are. But it does seem to indicate that nonetheless, his following is by those who at least believe he does miracles. I don't want to.
And that servant girl too, I was just adding another example.
Yeah. Good. I think there are other examples. And I think the thing is, maybe for us, it helps us, I think, not miss the point if we back it off just a little bit. And not that, I think that's a good question, and I would say keep exploring it, because I don't know the answer to that, but as far as whether they were actually doing it or faking. But I think if we back it up a little bit to our current culture, and I don't know what it would be, but just to pick some things at random, like if we said somebody who's a really good preacher who preached to tens of thousands of people, I think a lot of people see that as sort of a mark of fruit and spirituality. So let's say we take that. And then we take somebody who also gives a lot of money away, because I think we see that also as a mark of spirituality. So they're giving it away. And then we see maybe even, let's go even further. Let's say somebody who is doesn't fall into the trap a lot of celebrities do, and he is sexually pure, actually faithful and celibate and ascetic. He doesn't engage in inappropriate sex. So we might look at someone like that and say that person is righteous and spiritual. But I think we all know there could be somebody like that who has no relationship with Jesus, who is doing all those things because of the power that it gives them, because of the talents they have, because of their own sense of self-righteousness. And I think that's the kind of example Jesus would use with us, is here's a guy who looks good, but the question is he actually loving? You know, look at other things. Is he self-righteous? Is he judgmental? Is he telling the truth? Does he reflect good fruit in his heart? I think that's where Jesus would redirect what we're looking at. So that's easier, because those we can think of someone doing sincerely and still not be doing them from a relationship with Jesus. And that's how I think we're supposed to read it, whether they're faking it or not. He then goes on. And again, this you'll now see flows really well from what he's just said, right? There's going to be people who are going to say the right things. They're going to spouse the right things. They're going to even do some things. They don't know me. They haven't really heard this whole message. Their fruit doesn't reflect this kind of humble, pure of spirit approach that I'm calling you to. This righteousness, which is not a self-righteousness, this lack of judgment, this lack of hypocrisy, this generosity of spirit. These are the people he's saying you need to look for. And then he says this, therefore, and I think this is in contrast to the people he's just talked about. The people who have heard what he's saying and they're not doing it, they're taking the broad path, and that leads to destruction and doesn't even know him. Then he says, therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on a rock. And I love that everyone, because I think that's intentional. Again, he's saying to the fisherman, he's saying to the carpenter, he's saying to anybody out there, you do not have to have the knowledge the Pharisees have. You don't have to have the study or even the lineage, even the legacy, even the heritage. This could even refer to a Gentile. If there's a Gentile in the crowd and they are at a place they are able to hear it, they could take this and go, oh, he's talking about me, because it's so expansive. He says, everyone who hears these words of mine. It's even more specific than anyone, I think. Everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who builds his house on a rock. The rain comes down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against the house, yet it did not fall because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who has built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell with a great crash. I don't think this is so far removed from earlier when he said, is your treasure in things which will be destroyed? you know, moths and rust come in and destroy and thieves come in and steal. Now it's the rains, which will take it away. What is your foundation built on? Is it these things that look good, that everybody thinks of as power and spirituality? Or is it the true power of humility and meekness and poverty of spirit and submission to God and generosity of spirit to others and mercy and forgiveness and all these things he's just hit over and over and over and over and over? And he's saying, where are you building your life? And then he said, I understand a lot of people aren't going to go this way because it's weird. It's countercultural. It's not what the rest of the world encourages. But now he's saying, but the benefit is your house will stand. Your house will stand. No matter what happens, things come along, things aren't there. Your foundation is solid. Here again, does this apply to the gospel? Of course it does. Of course it does. And so if we, because that is the essence of what Jesus is teaching, but his hearers right now don't know that. They don't understand the idea of Jesus' death and atoning sacrifice. It definitely applies to that. But for them right now, and even with relevance to us, even in our lives, our salvation is secure. But what are we counting on as we live our life? Are we counting on what the culture says us is foundational? Or are we counting on this kind of life, this countercultural life, this tension-filled, challenging life of humility? Are we counting on that somehow to be our foundation? And ultimately, the humility means surrender, asking God, submitting to him, recognizing that in your poverty of spirit, he is your only hope. Which one will last? Well, of course, the world's going to be wrong, and everything the world tells us will last crumbles, but Jesus never crumbles because he's the eternal God. So I think that's kind of where all this is coming down to. Let me just finish up here with the Matthew 7 and Luke 6. It's just reiterating, and then we'll take some time to see what you guys are thinking. It says, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd were amazed at his teaching because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Now, this is an interesting phrase because you would think they thought of the teachers of the law as having authority. But in fact, I think this keys what it means. When it says he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law, what we remember is the teachers of the law are always just interpreting the scriptures that God has given them. Now, they go a long way with their interpretation and they disagree with each other and there's all sorts of room, but it always comes back to, you know, the scripture that's there. Now, in one sense, Jesus is doing the same thing, which is why I think they even give him a hearing, because he is saying, you've heard this, but now this. But notice how he stopped saying that. He said that at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. Now he's just kind of gone off. He's still saying things which are technically compatible with the law and the scripture because he is God and God is consistent. But he stopped saying, here's what you've seen. Here's what you've heard said. He's just started saying things now. And I think that's what it's referring to, that he's now speaking of a path which nobody else is speaking of. He's speaking of a path which is different enough from what the rest of the teachers of the law are telling them, that they're like, wow, he's talking to us like he has authority they don't have, which indeed he is. And that doesn't mean, it says they were amazed, doesn't mean they all liked it. I think there's probably a mix. There's people who are amazed at his teaching and they're like, what amazing arrogance he has to tell us that he has the way, that he's the foundation, that his teachings are everything. Because if he's not God, that is arrogant and it is foolish and it is dumb. But there's also those who are listening who are thinking, wow, that's amazing. He's talking as if he's God. He's talking as if he has authority to tell us what really is meant in the law. He's talking as if he has authority to give us this narrow gate. He's talking as if he has authority to actually be the foundation of our lives. And so whether they like what he's saying or don't like what he's saying, whether they believe his authority is valid or he's taking authority, which is invalid, they are still amazed that he's doing it. These things, and I think what it goes to is to show us how different what he's saying is from what the rest of the Jews have been hearing. And I think it's important for us to see that because we've been hearing these things so long, we forget how different they are. And I do want to reiterate and stress, they're still challenging and they're still countercultural. And if you only read scripture and hear Jesus's word affirming your current worldview, then I want to challenge you that I think that's not the, shouldn't always be the case. Sometimes at least the words of Jesus should be counter to what you think is right. They should be counter to the worldview you've become comfortable with. If it doesn't, then Jesus has become very small. But if he's big enough to actually be God, then unless we happen to live at a weird moment of time where culturally suddenly we've got it all right, which is really hard to argue, then I think you have to expect that there's going to be some things that are going to challenge you. And I think that's okay. I think that is part of what this message is intended to do, is to challenge you, to amaze you at its authority. Wow, Jesus says some amazing things. Luke goes on, he says this, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I will show you what they are like. They are like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid a foundation on rock. And when a flood came, the torrent struck the house, but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on a ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck the house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete." So there you go. Any thoughts, any comments on tonight before we wrap it up?
This is super helpful. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad. I find it really encouraging, personally. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it does make a big difference to like take it, like some of the stuff in here that's been taken out of context too.
Yeah, it helps.
I think that we have to be careful about that.
I do too. And I'm not, again, I think it's possible that there are some places where he is moving to a new thing and we don't have to force things to flow, but it does seem like they kind of do flow. And it does feel like there certainly are some key points that we can take. And that this idea of poverty of spirit, of humility, of, you know, the golden rule, you know, of submission and surrender to God, of lack of self-righteousness, those are definitely key points that are there. Whether you think they're disconnected key points or not, they're definitely key points that are there. I just happen to think they all kind of flow together too and are all pointing to that same message.
And it makes it a lot bigger, like when you read it in context.
Yeah, I agree. It really does. And it shows how similar Matthew and Luke's sermons really are. Even though they have some different elements and they go some different places and they put things in different order, when you recognize really their themes are the same, they are saying the same things. And I think it does make sense to say, this is the message Jesus gave over and over. You know, when he had a chance, this is what he preached.
Well, and that's helpful too, because I think I kind of thought of it more as, oh, this was a sermon he gave, but this is consistently what he was teaching. And it like did like prepare the way too for them to believe when he actually, you know, died and rose again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because you can see how this really does prepare the way for the gospel too. The recognition that righteousness is so deep, so pervasive, so difficult, so perfect, so impossible. And that somehow the way to it is through poverty of spirit and asking God really leads to the gospel, to where they're prepared for it, to say, oh, my righteousness can only come through recognizing my poverty of spirit and throwing myself at the mercy of Jesus. But that can be complete. That can actually make that righteousness full. It really does lead to that. You can kind of see that, not just in a tricky way, but it really is like the ABCs of the message that they're beginning to get. Yeah. I also love remembering that anytime Jesus speaks to anyone, the 12 apostles are there and they are learning more than anybody because they're there all the time. So when he says things like watch the fruit, or when he gives them these challenges, they think about the life they've watched Jesus lived. And they're like, boy, he actually does these things. You know, he actually turns the other cheek. He actually lives humbly, even though we believe he's God or at least the Messiah, you know? So for the apostles, when they hear him teach, and they're hearing about false prophets and true prophets, they're like 100%. You can see why they're so devoted, because they're like, yeah, he is very consistent. This is exactly who he is. His fruit really lines up with this. So if he's crazy, he's at least sincere in his craziness and he lives the way he's preaching, you know? And then of course, then they're like, and is that so crazy? You know, is it really? No, actually it makes a lot of sense when you think it through. Well, this does conclude that sermon. We'll move on with his ministry and see his fruit in his life and see his priorities in what he does now in his interactions with people. But I think it's helpful to remember that whenever he has a chance, when you hear about him preaching to the 5,000 or you hear about him preaching to the 10,000, you know, recognize this is probably what he's preaching. You know, this is the message he's giving. He's pushing people to this narrow path, to this countercultural approach. And unless it specifically tells us other things, and occasionally it does, this is probably the heart of what he's preaching at the big sermons. You'll notice when he talks to people individually, it's more personal and he says things differently. And I think that's good too. And we do get more hints of the gospel even there because he can tailor it to the person he's talking to. But you'll see this, obviously, this consistency as we go.
Thank you for joining us. The Journey is a ministry of Discipleship Matters, which is an extension of Focus Church and is created by David McGill for the purpose of helping equip pastors to build discipleship communities in their own churches. If you'd like to learn more about the books and conferences and coaching offered by David, you can check out his website, davidmcgill.com.